Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On this week's Solid Gold Winners Only show, I'm joined by the first French winner of the Palme d'Or in 21 years. Yes, Laurent Conté, director of one of my favourite films of the year, The Class, gives us an education. And Oscar winner James Marsh, director of the brilliant New York doc Man on Wire, turns his hand to Yorkshire next. We talk to him about his part in the upcoming Red Riding trilogy. Guardian film critic Zan Brooks joins me to give the verdict on Watchmen, The Young Victoria and Wendy and Lucy. Braver than a high wire walk across an inner city school playground, it's Film Weekly. A film winning plaudits all over the world is Laurent Conté's The Class. Entre les Murs, as it's known at home in France, won the Palme d'Or at last year's Cannes Film Festival and was nominated for an Oscar in the Best Foreign Film category, an unlucky loser, unfortunately. It's based on an autobiographical book by author and former teacher François Bégodeau. The film follows the attempts of a teacher to inspire a group of multiracial 14 to 15-year-old school students in a working-class suburb of Paris. Like a fly on the wall or a mouche sur les murs, let's go into that classroom to hear the fictional François Marin, the 30-something teacher, trying to calm his students down in the class.
Bien, 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 bien. Hey. Oh! On se calme maintenant.
Il fallait que je... Kumba.
Fus.
Mais vous croyez vraiment, je vais aller voir ma mère, je dirais fallu que je sois fus.
And before I hosted a special observer Q&A with Laurent Conté at the Curzon Mayfair in London recently, I had a word with the director for Film Weekly. It never seemed to me that you were a director who would one day be at the Oscars.
You know, it's a surprise for me too, but I'm quite happy because I didn't change my way of working. I didn't try to make a film for the Oscars or for one audience. I think I'm quite close to my previous preoccupations, so I didn't make any concession to make this film.
Do you think the world has got used to this aesthetic? It's taken some time, but now the mainstream can be very popular. This gritty, realistic aesthetic.
I think that if you look at the production. All the films that are released now, or all the selection in Cannes last Cannes Festival, we had a lot of film that had these very strong links with the reality. Sometimes more documentary, sometimes a little bit less. But I think the world is getting more and more difficult to grab. It's more and more difficult to understand what's going on, and that's maybe the reason why a lot of filmmakers wants to just look at what's happening around them and try to maybe not answer to all the questions, but ask a lot of questions about the situation.
Yeah. I think when you look at your film, I found myself asking questions about reality and capturing reality, because, as you say, it's sort of a documentary, but there is artifice. You did rehearse your class. It's not a complete improvisation, is it?
No, in fact, the film can look like a documentary film, but everything has been done several times, and I wrote a script first. Even before meeting the children, we wrote a first script, and we organized this workshop in a school with the children every Wednesday afternoon for 3 hours, sometimes more, because they wanted to stay a little bit longer. And of course, the script was enriched by all these meetings and by what they can tell me about their own way of living and what they consider as important in life and things like that. All the children of that class are members of that new culture, and tomorrow there will be another group, and this group will induce other way of thinking, other way of speaking, other way of behaving. And all the new immigrants, for example, bring with them something that our culture has to take in, yes.
The film, to me, is very much like your other films. It's about systems and institutions and restrictions. Be the in the French title is Entre les Murs. It's we don't have that in England. The restriction that you have, the corridors that you use, and the institutions that you're restricted by language and by rules and regulations, mm-hmm. and yet your characters find freedoms within those boundaries.
I think François, the teacher, is maybe very representative of all my main characters in all my films. He's someone, a sort of idealist, mm-hmm. Who is facing a system that is not as ideal as he wished, you know, and who is obliged to take in account all the rules and all, even if he tries to go through that, mm-hmm. you know.
Is that you as a filmmaker? Do you find, because you seem to have changed, as I mentioned before at the beginning, traditional aesthetic, mm-hmm. do you find that you have to change things, or is that just the way that you, Laurent Conté, are?
No, I don't have to fight for that. Maybe because I'm working with the same production company for a long time, that they trust me, that they help me to make the film I want to make, and also to make them the way I want to make them.
Mm. You'll see when in Hollywood when they come up to you and start throwing scripts at you for, you know, Bad Boys 3, and we'll see how Laurent Conté copes with that.
I'm waiting.
Laurent Conté talking to me earlier. And in the studio with me now is Zan Brooks. Welcome, Zan. What did you make of the class?
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah.
I really loved it. It really seemed to capture what it's like, I think.
What it's like, because I taught in a school in Paris just up the road from that one.
And another thing, I mean, a friend of mine actually teaches up in Nottingham, and I remember me saying to him, how can you cope with it when they're just kind of after you all the time? They're trying to destroy you. And he was saying, the thing to remember is that it's nothing personal. They're just kind of testing boundaries. If you remember that it's nothing personal, you can get through it. So and this film kind of caught that.
Do you see this film then as a trial for the teacher or as a trial for the kids?
Well, it's both, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty equal opportunities nightmare, really, from the looks of it.
Yeah, I find it very inspirational and uplifting as well.
Inspirational and uplifting without being cheesy and giving you the easy payoff.
Oh, yeah,
like
no,
a Hollywood movie
no
would have
dead
the
poet
kind of,
society.
Well, yeah, exactly. The Hollywood movie would have had the big payoff at the end, and this kind of just sort of dwindles out quite beautifully, I think.
Yeah, I love it. I'm really pleased with it. I'm surprised it didn't win an Oscar, but then, as we know, that was the big surprise of the night, that Departures, the Japanese film, won the Oscar. So, poor old Laurent Conté.
Well, he's got the Palme d'Or. I mean, what more does he want?
No more. If you were a director, Zan, I'm going to put this to you. What would you rather win? Oscar, Palme d'Or, BAFTA, or London Critics Circle Award?
Speaking as the chair. Do you know, if I was taking the high route, I'd go for Palme d'Or, but I suspect I'd grab the Oscar.
You would, wouldn't
sorry,
you?
Sorry, Laurent.
And you'd be sitting in a pool in Hollywood, mound of coke, loads of girls.
That's the dream.
That's it. Palme d'Or's nothing like that. let's move on to a film that I suspect will be troubling neither the jury at the Cannes nor the Academy at the Oscars this time next year. It's a film called Watchmen. It's directed by Zack Snyder, and it's about superheroes in the 1980s in their suits.
You know, it could have been a burglary. Maybe the killer didn't know who the comedian was.
An ordinary burglar killed a comedian. Ridiculous.
I heard he'd been working for the government since 77, knocking over Marxist republics in South America. Maybe it was a political killing or something.
Maybe. Maybe someone's picking off costumed heroes.
You don't think that's a little paranoid?
That what they say about me now? Paranoid?
Now, Zan, I'm going to confess, I haven't seen Watchmen. What I saw was a trailer for it. I saw that it was 160 minutes. Mm. I saw it was about superheroes, and it was based on a graphic novel by the famous Alan Moore. I 160 minutes of everything I hate. So I thought I'd let you tell me exactly about it.
Well, what I would suggest is you can probably glean a lot from the trailer in that it doesn't actually make much sense. And maybe it does. Well, maybe it does to the kind of fanboy element. And this is really going for the fanboy element. And I haven't read the Alan Moore graphic novel, surprisingly. But people who have say that this is actually faithful to a fault, and almost like the novel is a storyboard for the film.
They are. Graphic novels are. I don't see what's so clever about adapting graphic novels. They're done for you.
They're
anyway.
Done, yeah. Yeah. And perhaps it kind of loses some of the nuance, maybe. Maybe that's the thing that is missing here. I mean, the first couple of minutes are great. It starts with this kind of montage, which is a kind of crash course through a kind of alternative 20th century, leading us up to this fictional parallel universe 1985 where Nixon is still in the White House and, you know, and there are superheroes who've been outlawed and things like that. And it's sort of played to Bob Dylan's The Times They Are Changing. And it's kind of great. It's a real virtuoso
really?
Piece of filmmaking. I
None
promise
of those
you it
words
is.
Fill me with any hope.
Not Dylan?
No.
I'm not selling this.
You're
am
not.
I?
No, but I don't know who could sell it to me because, I mean, I saw the trailer and that's normally supposed to give you an idea of what it's about. I haven't got a clue.
Yeah, and it's one of those films that it's trying to kind of deconstruct the superhero genre.
Oh, well, that's a good thing.
And make them all out to be these kind of flawed screw-ups, you know, literally impotent sometimes, nursing these huge neuroses. And it does all that up to a point, but then it also wallows in all the kind of the genre cliches. So it is the sort of the costumes and the slow motion violence and the slightly kind of po-faced nature of it all. And it's impossibly kind of up itself and serious.
What I don't get, because we had that film the other week, Push, with little Dakota Fanning, which had the world populated by these kind of disenfranchised superheroes.
This is the same deal.
Power. So right, these people have got powers, but they don't know what to do with them.
Yeah, and the government is after them and they've got to kind of reunite and fight the forces of evil.
Do they live amongst us?
They do live amongst us.
In New York?
Next
or?
Door to you, in fact.
Really? I've always wondered what that door. Noise was in the middle of the night. I must have
Well, it could be Billy Crudup as Dr. Manhattan, who's a kind of... He looks like the Oscar with genitals. It's quite kind of alarming, really. Or it could be Patrick Wilson as this character called Night Owl, who is impotent, or Jackie Earle Haley as this kind of Sam Spade-ish kind of noir villain who's got a sort of ink blot over his face.
Is it raining a lot?
It's raining a lot. It's kind of the big gothic architecture. It's all there. And yet, you know, these are good actors and they do manage to kind of raise it. I'm a big fan of Billy Crudup and Jackie Earle Haley, who was in Little Children and is, you know, one of these great...
Wasn't Patrick Wilson in Little Children?
Yes,
he was,
yeah. That's funny reading. Exactly. So these are good actors and they do the best they can, but they're kind of covered by all this sort of latex and costumes and saddled to this sort of ridiculously convoluted plot.
It would suggest to me that, given the mantra from The Incredibles of no capes, darling, that they have not got a sense of humour.
No, they haven't
at all.
There's
a lot of capes.
No, this is a very kind of dour, serious movie. And the fact that it's so serious actually makes it a little ludicrous in the end.
Especially since it's directed by Zack Snyder.
Of 300 fame.
Yeah, exactly. He needs to get a sense of humour. Zach? Zach?
No, don't call me Zach.
Can I call you Zach, please? Zach, let's move on. We're going to go to something rather different. Although capes abound in this one too, it's The Young Victoria, starring Emily Blunt and Rupert Friend. She is the young Queen Victoria. They are trying to find her a mate for the rest of her life and reunite the empires of Hanover and Saxe-Coburg.
Of the modern composers, I suppose Vincenzo Bellini is my favourite.
What a coincidence. So is mine. Oh, which of his operas do you enjoy most? No, wait, let me guess. You Puritani?
As a matter of fact, yes.
I used to like it too. Now I prefer Norma.
Have I offended you in some way?
No.
And Schubert. I like Schubert. I think perhaps you don't, but I do.
I don't mind Schubert.
Good.
Written by Julian Fellowes, directed by Jean-Marc Vallée. This stars Emily Blunt and Rupert Friend, Zan. And this seems to me a bit like The Duchess, but forward wound about 130 years.
It is a bit. But it's The Duchess at least was kind of trying to undermine the whole kind of aristocratic scene, wasn't it? A bit.
Yeah, I thought it was.
It was asking questions about it. I mean, maybe it wasn't a great film, but it did have more of a sort of feminist take.
And great costumes.
And great costumes.
Oscar-winning
costumes. Martin O'Connor there. But this is slightly more genteel and decorous.
Yes.
And it's written by Julian Fellowes. It's got great production credits. This surely is the only film that is produced by both Martin Scorsese and the Duchess of York.
Sarah
which
Ferguson.
Is just wonderful.
And in fact has a pitch. I'm watching the opening credit, which is a sort of coronation-y thing. I don't know. One of many processions throughout this film. And there was Princess Beatrice or Eugenie, one of
Yeah,
right,
she's there.
Full screen,
yeah.
Big jowly face, cute, immediately recognisable. Poor thing. Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Ferguson.
But can you imagine those production meetings between Marty and Fergie? I mean, the arguments that they must have had. And yet, the weird thing is that I kind of think Fergie's won.
Yeah,
this is a kind of extended curtsy, really, of a film. It's very genteel. It's sort of a lot of the minutiae of kind of royal etiquette and very kind of respectful.
Yes, it is, and it's kind of. entertaining. I kind of quite enjoyed it, and I thought Emily Blunt was rather good.
I like Emily Blunt a lot. I think she's very good. I have to say I preferred her in something like My Summer of Love, but I even thought she was okay in The Devil Wears Prada.
Yeah, she was.
She was good in that. And she's good playing this kind of, you know, vulnerable person who has to come of age, and that's basically what
this
story is.
Isn't this basically like, you know, that Queen Victoria from the biscuit tins and the Empire? She was actually quite hot at one stage.
She was a bit of a fox, wasn't she, at one stage, way back in the day.
This was it. And that's basically... And Rupert Friend, who, strangely enough, is Keira Knightley's beau, I think, in real life. He's her boyfriend. And, of course, she was in The Duchess, Keira Knightley, playing the sort of same thing. She could have been a queen as well, exciting, but she wasn't. She was a duchess. But it was all the same. Oh, she was cute as well. And then Rupert Friend is not allowed in this one. He's in Emily Blunt. I was just like, the whole royal family of Great Britain is mixed in with the royal family of acting talent
in
Great Britain. And maybe it's a metaphor for that.
It's all inbred, isn't it?
Yeah.
There they are again. You know, meet the new boss same as the old boss, isn't
exactly. it? Exactly. So, I mean, whilst I didn't mind this, I just thought, why on earth is this existing when we don't need it?
Well, I guess it's existing for the American market that you know, want to come and visit Buckingham Palace, but until they can watch the young Victoria.
That's presumably the only reason, and why Martin Scorsese got involved, heaven knows.
Well, heaven knows. I mean, I guess his thing is that he can bring something different to it, like he said that he did with Age of Innocence. And actually, you know, when he made the Age of Innocence, he did this big thing that he was saying, actually, that world is just as vicious and violent as the world of the mafia or just, you know, low rent hoodlums on the Lower East Side. And yet here that doesn't come across at all, really. It
really
doesn't.
Those Germans are a bit untrustworthy, I would say.
This is a sort of meandering, minor key little bit of tourism, I think.
Isn't it? And directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, a French Québécois director who did that film Crazy,
which was good.
Which I liked. I was like,
which they're obviously thinking that he can bring something new to it. Yeah. But the form defeats all that.
Yeah, that's what this new kind of genre of heritage cinema is about, because they made Saul Dibb, who did Bullet Boy, do The Duchess. Yeah. And he did bring a kind of sort of zippy edge to it.
A little bit, but it's surface pyrotechnics. You can't actually reinvent the genre. It's been here for 1,000 years.
I'd like to see some real sex. If you're doing Young Victoria and She Was a Fox, I'd like to see her naked. I'd like to see kind of... They had 17 children or something like that.
Apparently they had an extensive porn collection.
And use of drugs, I think, as well.
Yeah, I mean, none of that's here.
No, bondage, the lot. That's what I want to see.
Are we going to see the sequel, Old Victoria?
We saw that with Judi Dench, and that's when I don't want to see the drugs, sex and rock and roll. Thank you very much, Zan. And The Young Victoria is out on general release from March the 6th. Let's change the tone somewhat and move to America for Wendy and Lucy, a film by Kelly Reichardt, which stars Michelle Williams and her dog, lost and stranded in small-town America.
Great dog. What's her name?
Lucy.
Your sweetheart, Lucy.
Where are you going?
Going to Alaska.
Woohoo! King salmon. You going to work? Can't sleep here, ma'am. You can't sleep out here. It's not allowed.
Okay.
So, and Kelly Reichardt did a lovely film called Old Joy, which was about small-town America and the sort of passing of time and a male friendship. Here's a very sort of different examination of friendship in that same cadre with Michelle Williams, who I like a lot.
Yeah.
Sort of a Peter Panish figure here with a little bob cut and kind of cut-off jeans and her dog.
And her dog, Lucy, a golden retriever. I was wondering about this. I was thinking, is this the first kind of American film of the American Depression, the new American Depression? There is a film basically on the breadline, and it's about people in poverty or in minimum wage
jobs. That's very
interesting
you say that, because it is. There's a Tom Sawyer-ish, Huck Finnish element to
it. But also kind of weirdly from a different country, it has a sort of slight, you know, slight feel of Bicycle Thieves, say.
Yes,
it does. It is this sort of little social
Honda
realist
Accord
fable.
Thieves.
Honda Accord Thieves. Dog Thieves. and so Michelle Williams is you know, a modern-day Huck Finn who's just kind of drifting, I guess, washes up in this little Oregon town, real kind of deadbeat town, is done for shoplifting, finds her dog has gone missing and must find him. It's Lucy. So, you know, it is that kind of little social realist slice of life. Mm. And it works very well. It's very short. But within that, it does capture a world, I think, a world that we very rarely see on screen.
I like this coming from a female director, not something we see enough. Mm. But I thought that there was a sort of very soft, delicate poetry to the way she builds her scenes. As you say, it's very short, but manages to pack in a lot of emotion. Not a lot happens, but there's a lot of emotions that we go through. And I thought Michelle Williams was absolutely brilliant. The best thing she's ever done here. We get to really visualize visualize her pain and her confusion and her lostness through her kind of search for this dog.
Yeah, without any kind of big histrionics. I mean, she's a very kind of stoic presence in this. She's sort of drifting from shopping mall to dog pound to mechanics to, you know, and you know, she's not giving out much, but what she gives out, it really kind of chimes, I think, and, yeah, and connects.
I see. I don't like dog movies.
Do you not like dog movies? You don't like dog movies, superhero movies?
No, I don't. I like movies, basically. I don't know what I'm doing here, to be honest with you, Sam. I love good movies. I love good movies, basically. And I love movies set in the here and now. And this is actually a movie very much up my street. This is up my main street, I suppose, because it is about here and now. And the dog is really a metaphor. The dog is a sort of almost a plot device, if you will.
Yeah.
Like, it's not really part of
this. It's
not
a sort of MacGuffin, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
Really?
It's not like Marley and Me, which I haven't seen yet, but that's got Jennifer Aniston and a dog in. And you know,
I'm
where
sure
you're
it's
going
very
already.
Different from Marley and Me.
So that's what I mean, the way they've used it is really good. And then, and Lucy is her friend, but she's really in search of a lot, this girl, Michelle Williams. They're very pained.
Yeah, and so Lucy is basically, she's clinging on to Lucy for what Lucy represents, which is, you know, home, love, you know, direction, everything, really. I mean, that's a lot to load a little dog with.
It is, absolutely. The dog does it very well, though.
There's good supporting performances here, too. I mean, really like Will Patton. Will Patton is one of the great kind of underrated character actors in American
absolutely.
Movies, and he plays this slightly venal mechanic. There's this guy called Wally Dalton, who I've never seen in anything before, and he looks like he's in his 70s, so surely he's been knocking around a bit, playing this sort of minimum wage security guard at this shopping mall that really doesn't need a security guard. Yeah. He's just standing outside, nobody's there, and that's a beautiful role.
Yeah, and there's also a little role for Kelly Reichardt's old friend,
Will Oldham.
Will Oldham, Prince Billy, isn't he, of the folk scene. Our folk listeners might know him. He has a little role, and does the music as well, and rather brilliantly, I think.
Yeah, yeah, he's superb, and he was in Old Joy, of course, and here he's got, like, basically, they obviously got him for one day, and he does, like, a little speech sort of out by the railroad tracks and then is gone. But you know, it's a good moment.
Fans of what's his name, David Gordon Green's George Washington might recognize the train tracks here and the kind of campfires by there and the down and out.
Absolutely. And it's always, these people always seem to be going to Alaska, don't they? Michelle Williams' character is on her way to Alaska, and Alaska is really like the last frontier in American life now. It's where you can go and begin anew. And you kind of think maybe she's not going to get there.
You've been to Alaska?
I have been to Alaska.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Can you begin anew there?
I tried, and then I came back here.
We needed you, Zan. Zan, thanks very much for returning from Alaska. Zan Brooks there. If you do want to catch any more of Zan's writing, go to guardian.co.uk/film. Last seen on the winner's podium at the Oscars, British director James Marsh steps into the limelight again this week as one of three directors behind Channel 4's Red Riding trilogy. Adapted from David Peace's epic noir novels, the trilogy is a thriller set against the backdrop of 1970s and 80s Yorkshire, at a time when the Yorkshire Ripper was devastating local communities. James Marsh is joined by Julian Jarrold and Anand Tucker as directors of the three novels. James has directed the middle segment, 1980, and he's on the line now. Welcome back to Film Weekly, James.
Thanks, Jason. I think we were talking Edinburgh, which was about 9 months ago.
Yeah, that was the first time you were on. And then we've had Simon Chin on to kind of keep us abreast of Man on Wire's amazing tippy-toe progress to glory. And so congratulations for the first time since I saw you on the podium at the Oscars.
Yes, indeed. Well, no, that film took us a long way, further than we ever thought we were going to go, quite honestly. I think we spoke in Edinburgh where we were just... I think it was the British premiere of Man on Wire, so that was some time ago. And since then, of course... we've picked up one or two very, you know, prestigious awards, which were, it's been fantastic.
Yeah, Biffers and BAFTAs, which was extraordinary. A night with you at the BAFTAs as well. When I saw the power of a BAFTA when we couldn't get into that party and you brandished your BAFTA.
Yes, I was waving it around like a magic
the
wand.
The doors opened, James.
Well, you should have been with us in LA, Jason, because the Oscar gets you even in even more sort of secret and mysterious places.
Really, I know it sounds childish and kind of slightly kind of, you know, Heat magazine-ish to ask you, but what was it like?
Well, I have to say, I was trying, you know, you think you're going to be cynical and cool about these things, but in fact, once you get sucked into it all, it's just brilliant. You should give yourself over to it. So we had a fantastic night. We ended up at Madonna's house. I think I can say that, but I can't say any more than that. We went to the Vanity Fair party, which is the kind of hot ticket there. And I sort of wandered in with just waving my Oscar at people. And, you know, it's like a sort of celebrity bar mitzvah. and you're part of it. That's the best thing of all. So, no, it was a brilliant night. And it really is like being Cinderella going to the ball.
Well, you deserve. I think you just totally deserve it. And as you do too, let's bring you thumping back to earth. Although there's no earthboundness at all about your 1980 in the Red Riding trilogy, because it's packed with stars as well. I must say, for a very bleak and kind of grim examination of 1980 in Yorkshire, everyone that knocks on the door is just a brilliant TV personality. Paddy Considine, Peter Mullen, David Morrissey, just a great cast you've assembled for this show.
I think a lot of it was to do with the scripts, which people were sort of aware of, and also David Peace's novels, which people are also aware of. And we really had, you know, the most amazing choices for cast, and I ended up with exactly who I wanted on that film. And we had the kind of cream of British TV and film talent at our disposal. And that was true across the board. You know, the series attracted the most fantastic actors. And, you know, the protagonist of my film is played by Paddy Considine. He plays a Manchester detective who's brought in to review the slow progress of the Ripper inquiry.
And it's a great reconstruction. I mean, obviously you remember the time itself, 1980, as I do. But you start your film with that assembly of news footage, I suppose, which really brings it kind of crashing back to you, the kind of the time, the ineptitude of the police, the fear that amongst residents.
What sort of man do you think is committing these murders?
He's a cool, intelligent, cunning individual.
Having a deep hatred of prostitutes.
The killer they call the Yorkshire Ripper.
Brutal murder, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, it was. Very brutal murder.
She's had very severe head injuries, other injuries which I don't wish to elaborate on this time.
Teeth marks left on her body that gave police the valuable information.
In the past 4 years, 12 women have died in the very same way.
I'd like to say that I curse him and that I hope he goes rotten for Mentifoot if the police don't get him first.
There's still a very strong memory of that time in Yorkshire, and particularly in Leeds and Bradford, where we were doing a lot of our shooting. And we'd hear, you know, stories about women, you know, going out with crash helmets on because they were, you know, frightened of the Ripper attacking. And so that the idea in the opening of the film was to create that sense of public fear. And it's actually a mixture of real archive with archive that I created and images that I created, and we sort of blend them all together to create this sort of way into this time and this place.
Oh, that's interesting you say that, James, because I was watching it, I was like, well, is that, where did he get that footage from? And of course you sort of did that with Man on Wire as well. You kind of reconstructed the bits that weren't
able. Yeah, we sort of weave it all together to create what hopes, you know, feels like a kind of organic whole. But that's a very important sort of way into that world, I felt. And then what Paddy does, or Peter Hunter does, is he's trying to get to the bottom of you know, the Ripper, and indeed what else is going on around the Ripper at that time. And of course, you pick up, you know, the series of works. I think each film works individually pretty well, but it's immeasurably better if you've seen the first film, 1974. And there are certain plot elements that we kind of rework and recast in that film, and certain characters that are quite minor in 74 that emerge as very major characters in 1980. That's also true of the last film too. So I think all in all, it's a very rewarding experience across the three films.
Yeah, it is extraordinary, because we don't normally do TV here on Film Weekly, but they're so cinematic. And I was wondering if it matters to you what you're shooting for, because you made a great cinematic experience, audience, crowd pleaser, if you like, out of Man on Wire. You've done Wisconsin Death Trip, which was kind of under the arena strand for BBC, but I saw it certainly on the big screen myself. Then you made a feature film, The King, which starred Gael Garcia Bernal, which, you know, premiered at Cannes, and I saw it there, and that was definitely a feature film. But it seems to me that none of these kind of formats matter to you, James.
Not at all. I mean, I think, you know, the great thing about 1980 and all the other stuff you mentioned is that they were, so I was given a lot of freedom to do what I wanted to do, and you just sort of see them as movies. I mean, that's Man on Wire was a documentary by definition, but for me it was very much a kind of just a big screen movie that I could make. And 1980, you know, it may be destined for television initially, and that's what, you know, it was sort of framed by that, if you like. But it was, again, I shot on 35mm. And with the kind of quality of the actors we had, I think it works really well on a big screen. And I hope it has that kind of life, you know, at least outside of the UK. But, you know, it's you know, I've been very fortunate in a way that I sort of bounce between documentaries and drama. And 1980, you know, it's pretty dark.
It is. But they're both about obsession and trying to set yourself a task and actually fulfil it as well. It struck me that
that's
those,
true. I mean,
they
both have these very obsessive protagonists. You know, Philippe Petit, the real protagonist of Man on Wire, and you know the character of Peter Hunter, who is driven to find out the truth. And of course, the more he finds out, the worse his life gets.
Exactly.
And he's sort of sinking in this sort of sea of evil. As the film unfolds and sort of groping for some kind of, you know, clarity. The more he knows, the worse it gets.
I almost couldn't bear it by the end, and I mean that in the highest possible regard and compliment to your work. James, I mean, it's obviously you've been spending a bit of time in 1974 New York with Man on Wire, in 1980 Yorkshire. You're sort of living in the past, James. Are you going to be brought into the present in some of your work in the near future? Did Madonna tempt you with a return to the big screen? James, always a pleasure to have you. Congratulations on Red Riding and good luck with your next project.
Brilliant, Jason. Good to talk to you again.
You too.
Cheers, take care.
Saddle.
Bye.
James Marsh on the line there. His film, 1980, as part of the Red Riding trilogy, plays on UK televisions on Thursday, March the 12th. That is all we have room for in this winner-packed edition of Film Weekly. My thanks to my gold star guest, to Laurent Conte, to James Marsh, and of course to my regular companion in the pod, Zan Brooks. My regular producer, Jason Phipps, has been away this week. You wouldn't notice he's been replaced by the gorgeous Sarah Peters, thanks to her. Until next week, from me, Jason Solomons, it's goodbye.